Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 560, titled Economics 911. This is being recorded on July 9th of the year 2006. Before we get into the main body of the program, let me alert listeners, or remind listeners in the case of veteran members of the audience, that there is a vast amount of material available on the Internet. Those of you who are only following the broadcasts themselves, the For the Record broadcasts themselves, are missing out on a tremendous amount of printed information. The greater part of the For the Record experience at this point can be found in print online. www.spitfirelist.com is the website for Spitfire, the CD duplication service that distributes this work. And in addition to the vast amount of material, program descriptions of article length, entire long out-of-print anti-fascist books available for download, there are links to a number of different websites, audio websites maintained by WFMU that have the entire For the Record series archived on audio file, and many other websites as well, a blog spot, a site maintained by listeners in the Midwest with the declassified documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. It's a tremendous amount of information available, and every For the Record program is turned into an article-length description, so please, please, I can't stress strongly enough, take advantage of those descriptions. Also, there's a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing, and if you don't like what you hear here, there's no better way to do something about it than to support the work itself. Okay, more about that, time permitting, at the end of this side and or the second side. What we're going to be looking at in Economics 911 are some of the economic implications of September 11th and related topics, such as the invasion of Iraq. What has been taking place from an economic standpoint has been to a certain extent overlooked, and the more time passes, the more convinced I am that the economic aspects of September 11th and related topics are certainly as important, if not more important, than others. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from Newsweek, from their msnbc.com/Newsweek website. It's a very insightful article about the economics of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization that began in 1928, was allied with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. It then jumped in turn to British intelligence, the CIA, and finally came to rest under the auspices of Saudi Arabia, where it drew on the tremendous oil wealth of that country and also continued to be sponsored in various activities by elements of CIA and other intelligence services. The key there is the anti-communist and, above all, free market slash corporatist economic paradigm adhered to by the Muslim Brotherhood. In For the Record 455, among other programs, and this will be reproduced in the description for this broadcast, we specifically discussed the economic implication, or the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is corporatist, basically, along the lines of Mussolini's corporate state. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is, of course, an Islamic organization, so that it differs in certain relatively small areas from classic fascism or even German National Socialism. But nonetheless, one of the important things to understand in assessing September 11th is that there are very powerful economic and political elements in this country that are allied with the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, the MAK in Afghanistan, the Afghan Mujahideen, and Al-Qaeda are all offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood, as is Palestinian Islamic Jihad. These are branches of the Muslim Brotherhood. And even as the United States is at war with the Muslim Brotherhood in various places, and some of the 911 conspiracists notwithstanding, it's a very, very real war, but it's a very complex situation. The fact of the matter is that because of the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, and because of some of the institutional investment connections between powerful elements in this country and powerful elements in the Muslim world, in fact, there are very significant power interests in the United States that are allied with the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoots, at least philosophically, much the way that many of the members of the power elite in the United States during the Second World War were allied with the very fascists that the United States was fighting on the battlefield. Again, September 11th is a complex situation. One should not oversimplify it. But in terms of understanding how we could be both fighting a war with such an organization and yet at the same time elements in this country are in bed with it, understanding the Second World War would be a good paradigm to compare it to. Now, this article is called Islam in Office. It's by Stephen Glain, G-L-A-I-N, of Newsweek. It's from the July 3rd through 10th of 2006 issue. And one of the things that's pointed out here, and again, this is Newsweek, so it does not hit as hard as it could, but the Muslim Brotherhood's corporatist economic philosophy is absolutely consistent with laissez-faire globalist free market economics. And that, I suspect, is one of the major reasons why the Muslim Brotherhood has enjoyed the support of power interests in the United States, and why one finds, for example, when Operation Green Quest's raids of March 20th, 2002 took place, they revealed, among other things, very strong political and institutional links between the Muslim Brotherhood slash Al-Qaeda slash Hamas slash Islamic, Palestinian Islamic Jihad funding apparatus in the United States and the Bush administration and key GOP operatives like Grover Norquist. This article basically lays out, in I think fairly clear fashion, the free market philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it is because of this philosophy that powerful elements in this country are supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, even as American fighting men and women are dying on the battlefield fighting against it. That was the case in World War II with classical and not and National Socialist fascism, and it is the case today with Islamofascism, and in turn the relationship between the Bush administration and the Underground Reich and the Underground Reich's relationship with the Brotherhood. Yeah, that's a mouthful, but listen carefully, because we're going to move from an analysis of the Muslim Brotherhood's free market philosophy to some of the institutional connections of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. Stephen Glain writes in the Newsweek issue of July 3rd through 10th, Islam in Office, it reads as follows. Judeo-Christian scripture offers little economic instruction. The book of Deuteronomy, for example, is loaded with edicts on how the faithful should pray, eat, bequeath, keep the holy festivals, and treat slaves and spouses, but it's silent on trade and commerce. In Matthew, when Christ admonishes his followers to, quote, give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, unquote, he is effectively conceding fiscal and monetary authority to pagan Rome. Islam is different. The Prophet Muhammad, himself a trader, preached merchant honor, the only regulation that the borderless Levantine market knew. In Muslim liturgy, the deals cut in the souk became a metaphor for the contract between God and the faithful. And the business model Muhammad prescribed, according to Muslim scholars and economists, is very much in the laissez-faire tradition later embraced by the West. Prices were to be set by God alone, anticipating by more than a millennium Adam Smith's reference to the invisible hand, unquote, of market-based pricing. Merchants were not to cut deals outside the souk, an early attempt to thwart insider trading. Today, with a spiritual revival sweeping much of the Muslim world and with the Bush administration still keen on democratizing the region, it is worth asking how an Islamist movement would manage the economy. Since 2001, Islamist parties have made strong showings or won elections in 10 Arab countries, Morocco, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Bahrain, Egypt, Kuwait, and Pakistan, and the Palestinian Authority. And none are clashing with the West on free market economics. In Iraq, the supply-side economic reform plan submitted in 2003 by former U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer has survived with only minor revisions under Baghdad's new Shia-dominated government. An interesting test came in the January election in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood, the fountainhead of modern Islamism, took a fifth of the seats in parliament. Now the largest opposition party, much of the Brotherhood's appeal rests on its network of hospitals, schools, and charities, which are often superior to state services, and help explain why the secular regime cracks down harder on the secular opposition than on the religious one. Fortunately for the reform-minded Prime Minister, Ahmed Nazif, the Brotherhood's economic agenda is largely consistent with his own, albeit with a more populist twist. The Brotherhood embraces free trade deals in general, but criticizes the government for failing to negotiate better terms for Egyptians. Though Islam tends to frown on tax collection, the Brotherhood supports tax reform, not abolition, and opposes a proposed flat tax as regressive. It even endorsed the recent decision to lift budget-busting food and fuel subsidies, but wants to use Egypt's ample natural gas reserves to finance a less painful transition to market prices. Quote, "It must be done gently," says Mohammed Habib, the Brotherhood's first deputy chairman, "with the objective of reducing the gap between rich and poor," unquote. Parenthetically, a lot of the rhetoric here sounds quite good, but the realities of practice are something else again. Continuing. In the 1950s, as the Brotherhood gained political momentum, it opposed President Gamal Abdel Nasser as much for his decision to nationalize the Egyptian economy as for his fierce secularism. Mohammed, says Yasser Abdo, a Muslim Brotherhood member and a former economist at the International Islamic Bank for Investment and Development in Cairo, quote, "believed in the private sector as the basis of productive activity," unquote, with a limited, unquote, state role. Today, Brotherhood parliamentarians remain anti-statist and staunchly anti-trust, citing a verse in the Quran, quote, "He who brings commodities to the market is good, but he who practices monopolies is evil," unquote. Not that any member goes as far as questioning the OPEC cartel. As Cairo University economist Abdel Hamid Abu Zayed puts it, Islam promotes, quote, "competition of a cooperative nature, not the cutthroat Western kind." Politically, at least, the objective of fundamentalist Islam is to restore the Islamic Caliphate, the unified Muslim kingdom of the 7th to the early 20th centuries that stretched from the Hindu Kush to the Strait of Gibraltar. This rhetoric turns more practical on the subject of trade. Quote, "If the ancient caliphate can revive itself," says Habib, who has a U.S. doctorate in geology, "it will happen through regional commerce," unquote. A Brotherhood in power, says Habib, would respect Cairo's free trade agreements, though the group appears to be divided over whether it would honor one with Israel. In the days of the Caliphate, Islam developed the most sophisticated monetary system the world had yet known. Today, some economists cite Islamic banking as further evidence of an intrinsic Islamic pragmatism. Though still guided by a Quranic ban on riba or interest, Islamic banking has adapted to the needs of a booming oil region for liquidity. In recent years, some 500 Islamic banks and investment firms holding $2 trillion in assets have emerged in the Gulf states, with more in Islamic communities of the West. British Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown wants to make London a global center for Islamic finance, and elicits no howl of protest from fundamentalists. How Islamists might run a central bank is more problematic. Scholars say they would manipulate currency reserves, not interest rates. The Muslim Brotherhood hails 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun as its economic guide. Anticipating supply-side economics, Khaldun argued that cutting taxes raises production and tax revenues, and that state control should be limited to providing water, fire, and free grazing land, the utilities of the ancient world. The World Bank has called Ibn Khaldun the first advocate of privatization. His founding influence is a sign of moderation. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. Well, indeed, I think that article has some very important insights, and if some of the strange bedfellows that we find in connection with September 11th proves to be a confusing situation to unravel for many people, I think the Muslim Brotherhood's endorsement of free market economics helps, I think, for us to understand how it is that September 11th notwithstanding, American fighting forces have put an Islamic fundamentalist government in power in Iraq and done much the same thing in Afghanistan. I haven't spoken much about Afghanistan recently, but there was a well-publicized story in which an Afghani Muslim who converted to Christianity, was basically forced out of the country under pain of a threat of death. Basically, he was going to be executed in accordance with Islamic law for converting to Christianity. That, I think, is as telling an act, or as telling an element to reveal what is taking place in Afghanistan as any I can think of. If some of this seems hard to embrace, I think examining that article as well as the Muslim Brotherhood's corporate economic philosophy as set forth in not only For the Record 455, but in the book Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, I think will help us to clarify the situation. Because indeed, for all of the anti-Al-Qaeda rhetoric that we hear from George Bush, and I don't doubt that he personally has no use for Osama bin Laden, the fact of the matter is, as set forth at great length in the book Dollars for Terror, the Muslim Brotherhood, because of its free market economic philosophy, is looked upon with great favor by the multinational corporate community. And American arms have been put, and also the American political impetus has been put to work supporting, quote, democracy, unquote, which has actually brought the Muslim Brotherhood to power in many areas that they were previously not in power. I would note that in places like Iraq, which had something of the Nasser Egyptian model of economics, and who knows, perhaps ultimately in Syria as well, the Muslim Brotherhood is being favored as an alternative to state-controlled economic systems. And I think that, and indeed, note that the Bush's push for democracy is helping to install Islamic fundamentalist governments of the Muslim Brotherhood variety in many foreign countries, and or strengthening them in countries that they are not yet the dominant element, such as Egypt. Again, this would seem strange at first glance, but when one looks at one level, at the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, it is at one with the economic philosophy of people like Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, the founders of the Islamic Institute, a Muslim Brotherhood slash Al-Qaeda slash Hamas area of intersection with the GOP and the Bush administration. One interesting thing, before we go back, and we're going to touch on Grover Norquist, we're going to touch on Operation Green Quest, we're going to touch on the Islamic Institute, there's been a lot of rhetoric in the United States about the, quote, Israel lobby or the, quote, Zionist establishment having precipitated the Iraq War. I suspect a lot of that comes from the fact that there are a few Jews who are supportive of Israel who also were supportive of the Iraqi invasion. I think a lot of it comes from Paul Wolfowitz himself. Wolfowitz obviously has a Jewish last name. What a lot of the anti-Semites, and I think frankly their anti-Semitism is running rabid, particularly in the American, quote, left, unquote. Paul Wolfowitz isn't Jewish. He carries a Jewish last name. His father was Jewish. He carries his father's name, but he is not Jewish, does not practice the Jewish religion, and in fact has been romantically involved for the last several years with a Muslim woman from Saudi Arabia. His fellow traveler, so to speak, Grover Norquist of the Islamic Institute, has actually married a Palestinian Muslim woman and has been evasive on questions as to whether he himself has converted to Islam. But again, as we look at the bizarre political landscape, and a very terrifying political landscape it is, I think understanding the free market philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood can help us to unlock some of these quandaries. A very interesting article was authored by Greg Palast, the American, well, he was expatriate, he's now largely based in the U.S. He authored an article for Tycoon magazine of July and August of 2006. It's called, Was the Invasion of Iraq a Jewish Conspiracy? Subtitled, Did the Jews Do It? It's dated June 26th of 2006. Palast, by the way, I'm not going to take the time to read the entire article. Palast is actually being ironic here. And one of the things he notes is that the ball game, so to speak, in Iraq was not produced by Zionists. Talking about something that has proved utterly disastrous in Iraq, which was the free market economics that were put in power, basically resulted in a kleptocracy in Iraq. He notes, basically, that the author of the free market economic program that was put in power after the American invasion of Iraq was most definitely not made out by Zionists or Jews. Greg Palast writes in the article, it was more like a corporate takeover, except with Abrams tanks instead of junk bonds. Remember in this context the Muslim Brotherhood's economic philosophy at one with the economic philosophy of the elements behind the Bush administration. Beginning again and skipping down, it was more like a corporate takeover except with Abrams tanks instead of junk bonds. It didn't strike me as the work of a kosher cabal for an imperial Israel. In fact, it smelled of pork. Pig heaven for corporate America looking for a slice of Iraq, and I suspected its porcine source. I gave it a big sniff, and sure enough, I smelled Grover Norquist. Norquist is the copy-de-copy of right-wing big-money influence peddlers in Washington. Those jealous of his inside track to the White House call him Gopher Nose Twist. A devout Christian, and parenthetically he may now be a devout Muslim, a devout Christian, Norquist channeled $1 million to the Christian Coalition to fight the devil's tool, legalized gambling. He didn't tell the coalition that the loot came from an Indian tribe represented by Norquist's associate Jack Abramoff. The tribe didn't want competition for its own casino operations. I took a chance and dropped in on Norquist's L Street office, and under a poster of his idol, Nixon, now more than ever, Norquist took a look at the recovery, unquote, plan for Iraq and practically jumped over my desk to sign it, filled with pride at seeing his baby. Yes, he promoted the privatizations, the tax limit for the rich, and the change in copyright law, all concerns close to the hearts and wallets of his clients. So again, note who the basic author of the privatization of Iraq was. It's Grover Norquist. And as we've seen in many programs, including For the Record broadcast number 454 and For the Record program number 515, Grover Norquist, as well as Karl Rove, were basically the driving forces behind the creation of the Islamic Institute. That is actually a Muslim Brotherhood branch, for all intents and purposes, of the Republican Party. And when the Operation Green Quest raids took place on March 20th of 2002, it revealed the most profound connections between the Muslim Brotherhood, elements that were funding Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the GOP. And the Bush administration. That's the same GOP and the same Bush administration that is now screaming bloody murder basically pushing to have the editors of the New York Times tried for treason for talking about Operation Green Quest. Now, Operation Green Quest has been known for a long time. Its most important raid, the March 20th, 2002 raids, basically revealed strong links between the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist financing apparatus in the United States and the GOP. Furthermore, Operation Green Quest was transferred from the Treasury Department to the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security, of course, is headed up by Michael Chertoff, and Chertoff represented, when he was in private practice in the late 1990s, Dr. Magdi El-Amir, a prominent New Jersey physician who was an apparent financier of Al-Qaeda. So again, as one examines the rhetoric that the GOP is ratcheting up predictably in this election year, understand what lies behind it. Not only a tremendous amount of hypocrisy, but also a classic example of what at first glance would be strange bedfellows when you have Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and their ilk in bed with the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, that would seem pretty strange at first, but not when one examines the Muslim Brotherhood's economic philosophy, which is at one with those of Karl Rove, Grover Norquist et al. But also, as we'll see, time permitting later in the program, there are also very strong investment connections between the Saudis and other backers of the Muslim Brotherhood and the elements backing George Bush. Again, we have been treated in recent weeks with some of the, by now, almost routinely hysterical rhetoric that the Bush administration has cited, or has employed, I should say, to bash its critics. The following comes from a defense website, not a Department of Defense website, but it's defensetech.org, and it basically has the following, and this is an article that basically was put on their website. The full annotation will be available. It's called White House New York Times Bashers, quote, hypocrites, unquote. This is from June 28th of 2006. Again, the title, White House New York Times Bashers, Hypocrites. It reads in part, since 9/11, nobody, and I mean nobody, has done more reporting on the government's attempts to track terrorists through their data trails than the National Journal's Shane Harris. The guy ate spam and knocked back taquizas with John Poindexter, for Christ's sake. So I couldn't be more psyched to welcome Shane to the Defense Tech family. This is the first of what I hope will be a long string of posts for the site. Bush administration officials have been lining up to condemn the New York Times for revealing a program to track financial transactions as part of the war on terrorism. But if the Times' revelations about a program to monitor international exchanges is so damaging, why has the administration been chattering about efforts to monitor domestic transactions for nearly 5 years? Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many journalists, including this one, were briefed by U.S. customs officials on Operation Green Quest, an effort to roll up terrorist financiers by monitoring, among other things, suspicious bank transfers and ancient money lending programs favored by people of Middle Eastern descent. And skipping down, since 9/11, the Treasury Department has produced dozens of news releases and public reports detailing its efforts. Though officials appear never to have mentioned the SWIFT program, they have repeatedly described their cooperation with financial networks to identify accounts held by people and organizations linked to terrorism. Representative Peter T. King, Republican of New York, convened a hearing in 2004 where Treasury officials described at length their efforts assisted by financial institutions to trace terrorists' money. But he has been among the most vehement critics of the disclosures about the SWIFT program, saying editors and reporters of the New York Times should be imprisoned for publishing government secrets. Well, again, that is not only hypocritical, but when Operation Green Quest got into full swing, so to speak, in early 2002, the March 20th raids of that year revealed strong operational links between the Muslim Brotherhood's apparatus in this country and the fellow free marketeer philosophers of the Muslim Brotherhood, people like Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, et al. As I mentioned in For the Record 555, my most recent conversation with Daniel Hopsicker, what really is going on here is a money-go-round, and little things like wars, be it World War II or the current unpleasantnesses around the world, is not seen as particularly decisive by the powers that be. The idea is to keep the money going, and well, if poor slobs, maybe a few millions on each side, wind up dying, the idea is to keep the money going around. Do check out the other websites, link to www.spitfirelist.com, not only the For the Record section with long article-length descriptions of the For the Record broadcast, but there are numerous old and very important anti-fascist books available for download for free. There are audio files maintained by sister station WFMU. There's a blog sphere for the Record programs and the AFAs, and a wealth of material as well. Again, there's also a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing, and unfortunately my efforts aren't backed by the Muslim Brotherhood or the other corporatist free market advocates, so I'm kind of stuck there. But if you want to help out, it'll be certainly welcome. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 560, Economics 911. This has been recorded on July 9th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 560, titled Economics 911. This program is being recorded on July 9th of the year 2006. And again, before we plunge into the main elements of argument here, please be aware of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the vast amount of material on that website and linked websites, material both in print and audio, because those of you who are only listening to the For the Record broadcasts themselves are missing the vast amount of the For the Record experience, to coin a term. So please take advantage of those websites. Now, inside one of the program, we were taking a look at how the corporatist slash free market economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, the Afghan Mujahideen, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, among other groups, an Islamic fascist group with a heritage stretching back to the World War II period and before, we took a look at how the corporatist slash free market economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood is at one with the globalized, laissez-faire economic philosophy of not only the Bush administration, but more importantly, the corporate elements behind the Bush administration. This should not be dealt with in a facile way, because it's a political slash economic landscape that is as complex as it is deadly. But nonetheless, I think in an attempt to unravel some of these complexities, it's important to understand not only the philosophical points of alignment between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Bush administration, its enemy on the battlefield, but one should also understand that there are strong investment connections as well. In particular, with the rise in oil prices over the last 30-plus years, a tremendous amount of capital has gone into the coffers of the Arab oil-producing nations, and in turn, they have reinvested in a profound way in Western economies, and that reinvestment, not just economies, but also in non-commercial institutions, funding university Middle Eastern studies programs. A lot of that money has been recycled into the Western economy and is having a profound effect. So when we look, for example, at the Islamic Institute of Karl Rove and Grover Norquist, that is an institution which is a point of intersection between the Muslim Brotherhood and the GOP. It also is an outgrowth of the strong investment connections between many of the Middle Eastern oil kingdoms and corporate elements in the United States and elsewhere. At the end of Side 2, we were looking at an article from a defense website, that noted the hypocrisy of the Bush administration bashing the New York Times for having revealed some details about the SWIFT program. Well, the Bush administration has not only been touting its attempts at interdicting terror finance for a long time, but in fact, when Operation Green Quest got underway and when the March 20th, 2002 Green Quest raids were conducted as a result of a lawsuit filed by the heroic John Loftus, and also another equally heroic person, a woman named Rita Katz, who wrote a book called Terrorist Hunter under the pseudonym of Anonymous. Rita Katz did a lot of the bedrock research for the March 20th, 2002 Green Quest raids. What those raids revealed were profound connections between the Muslim Brotherhood terror financing apparatus in the United States and the GOP and people like Grover Norquist and Karl Rove. Those investigations were initially conducted under the auspices of Treasury. Treasury Secretary O'Neill was fired X number of months after those raids were conducted. He basically got a dressing down from Talat Altman, a member of the board of directors of Bush's Harkin Energy Company, a key member of the Norquist Karl Rove Islamic Institute, and somebody who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in 2000. Basically, Talat Altman told then-Treasury Secretary O'Neill, hands off of the people that you are dealing with. And indeed, not much came of the Operation Green Quest raids. We should also note that if those raids had been properly followed up on, then they would have led to, among other things, Yaqub Mirza. Yaqub Mirza set up the core various fronts that were raided on March 20th, and also the Muslim Brotherhood funding institutions in the United States, and yet he was never arrested, even though he set up these basically enemy institutions in the United States. Yaqub Mirza also is a key director of PTEC, and if one investigates Operation Green Quest properly, one also comes across the PTEC firm and the anomalous performance of air defense units on September 11th can in many ways, I suspect, be explained by the fact that the threat assessment software architecture for the Air Force and the FAA, among other institutions, was developed by PTEC, which is, for all intents and purposes, a Muslim Brotherhood-financed corporation. I would note that, as we have seen in, among other programs, For the Record 454, after the Operation Green Quest raids, elements of FBI and CIA cracked down on the people who, like Rita Katz and John Loftus, who would actually help to launch the Operation Green Quest raids. I'll put citations in the description for this broadcast. So again, one should note the ironies surrounding Operation Green Quest and the tremendous hypocrisy of the Bush administration in bashing the New York Times. What we're going to look at next concerns Osama bin Laden as a de facto Bush ally, or maybe it should be viewed as the other way around. As Robert Perry, the heroic investigative journalist who runs the ConsortiumNews.com website, has noted, there is a symbiosis between bin Laden and Bush. As I noted, well before the 2000 election, in fact, the bin Ladens and the Bushes were investment partners. But even beyond that, the political agendas of George Bush and Osama bin Laden dovetail in a number of very interesting ways. And again, underlying that, I suspect, at least in part, is the fact that the economic interests behind Osama bin Laden and George Bush are the same. Not only underground Reich economic interests, but the Muslim Brotherhood's Islamic fascist and free market agenda as well. And indeed, when George Bush goes around touting democracy, even as he and the elements he represents are undermining democracy, or what's left of it, in the United States, fixing elections, intimidating opponents, and generally disregarding constitutional authority, Bush is touting democracy in areas around the world, such as the Middle East, and what is coming to power in these newly empowered, quote, democracies, unquote, is the fascist Muslim Brotherhood with its free market, globalized, laissez-faire economic philosophy, something very dear to the hearts of people like George Bush and Grover Norquist and Karl Rove. One of the things that Robert Perry has noted in a recent posting on his ConsortiumNews.com website is a CIA analysis of an address that Osama bin Laden released 4 days before the 2004 election. This article is titled, CIA, Osama Helped Bush in 2004. It's by Robert Perry. It's dated July 4th of 2006. It reads in part as follows. On October 29, 2004, just 4 days before the U.S. presidential election, al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden released a videotape denouncing George W. Bush. Some Bush supporters quickly spun the diatribe as Osama's endorsement of John Kerry, unquote. But behind the walls of the CIA, analysts had concluded the opposite, that bin Laden was trying to help Bush gain a second term. This stunning CIA disclosure is tucked away in a brief passage near the end of Ron Suskind's The 1% Doctrine, which draws heavily from CIA insiders. Suskind wrote that the CIA analysts based their troubling assessment on classified information, but the analysts still puzzled over exactly why bin Laden wanted Bush to stay in office. According to Suskind's book, CIA analysts have spent years, quote, parsing each expressed word of the al-Qaeda leader and his deputy, Zawahiri. What they learned over nearly a decade is that bin Laden speaks only for strategic reasons. Quote, there, the CIA's assessments at day's end are a distillate of the kind of secret internal conversations that the American public was not sanctioned to hear. Strategic analysis. Today's conclusion, bin Laden's message was clearly designed to assist the president's re-election. Let me interject at this point that in past analysis of the Bush-slash-bin Laden rhetorical exchanges, I noted not only that an alleged al-Qaeda offshoot, an organization called the Abu Hafs al-Masri Brigade, had a public communique in which they stated in no uncertain terms that Bush was a tremendous asset for their movement and they would do nothing to threaten his re-election because they considered him to be such an asset. Al-Qaeda in Iraq had a similar pronouncement, basically saying that that Bush, with his various policies, was assisting the Islamist cause. And in light of some of the discussion that we engaged in on side one, I think one should view not only what I just said, but what we're about to read in a greater and deeper perspective. Returning once again to CIA, Osama helped Bush in 2004, quote, At the 5 o'clock meeting, Deputy CIA Director John McLaughlin opened the issue with the consultants with the consensus view. Bin Laden certainly did a nice favor today for the president, unquote. McLaughlin's comment drew nods from CIA officers at the table. Jamie Mischick, a CIA Deputy Associate Director for Intelligence, suggested that the Al-Qaeda founder may have come to Bush's aid because bin Laden felt threatened by the rise in Iraq of Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Bin Laden might have thought his leadership would be diminished if Bush lost the White House and their eye-to-eye struggle, unquote, ended. But the CIA analysts also felt that bin Laden might have recognized how Bush's policies, including the Guantanamo prison camp, the Abu Ghraib scandal, and the endless bloodshed in Iraq, were serving Al-Qaeda's strategic goals for recruiting a new generation of jihadists. Certainly, unquote, the CIA's Mischick said, he would want Bush to keep doing what he's doing for a few more years, unquote, according to Susskind's account of the meeting. As their internal assessment sank in, the CIA analysts drifted into silence, troubled by the implications of their own conclusions. Quote, an ocean of hard truths before them, such as what did it say about U.S. policies that bin Laden would want Bush reelected, remained untouched, unquote, Susskind wrote. One immediate consequence of bin Laden breaking nearly a year of silence to issue the videotape the weekend before the U.S. presidential election was to give the Bush campaign a much-needed boost. From a virtual dead heat, Bush opened up a 6-point lead, according to one poll. The implications of this new evidence are troubling, too, for the American people as they head toward another election in November 2006 that also is viewed as a referendum on Bush's prosecution of the, quote, war on terror, unquote. As we have reported previously at consortiumnews.com, a large body of evidence already existed supporting the view that the Bushes and the bin Ladens have long operated with a symbiotic relationship that may be entirely unspoken, but nevertheless has been a case of each family acting in ways that advance the interests of the other. Before Al-Qaeda launched the September 11, 2001 terror attacks against New York and Washington, Bush was stumbling in a presidency that many Americans felt was headed nowhere. As Bush took a month-long vacation at his Texas ranch in August of 2001, his big issue was a plan to restrict stem cell research on moral grounds. Privately, Bush's neoconservative advisors were chafing under what they saw as the complacency of the American people, unwilling to take on the mantle of global policeman as the world's sole superpower. The neocons hoped for some Pearl Harbor, unquote, incident that would galvanize a public consensus for actions against Iraq and other, quote, rogue states, unquote. Other senior administration officials, such as Vice President Dick Cheney, dreamed of the restoration of the imperial presidency that, after Richard Nixon's Watergate scandal, had been cut down to size by Congress, the courts, and the press. Only a national crisis would create cover for a new assertion of presidential power. Meanwhile, halfway around the world, bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda militants were facing defeat after defeat. Their brand of Islamic fundamentalism had been rejected in Muslim societies from Algeria and Egypt to Saudi Arabia and Jordan. Bin Laden and his lieutenants had even been expelled from the Sudan. Bin Laden's extremists had been chased to the farthest corners of the planet, in this case the caves of Afghanistan. At this critical juncture, Al-Qaeda's brain trust decided that their best hope was to strike at the United States and count on a clumsy reaction that would offend the Islamic world and rally angry young Muslims to Al-Qaeda's banner. So by early summer 2001, the clock ticked down to 9/11 as 19 Al-Qaeda operatives positioned themselves inside the United States and prepared to attack. But U.S. intelligence analysts picked up evidence of Al-Qaeda's plans by sifting through the chatter, unquote, of electronic intercepts. The U.S. warning system was, quote, blinking red, unquote. Over the weekend of July 4th, 2001, a well-placed U.S. intelligence source passed on a disturbing piece of information to then-New York Times reporter Judith Miller, who later recounted the incident in an interview with Alternet. The person told me that there was some concern about an intercept that had been picked up, Miller said. The incident that had gotten everyone's attention was a conversation between two members of Al-Qaeda. As they had been talking to one another, supposedly expressing disappointment that the United States had not chosen to retaliate more seriously against what had happened to the destroyer USS Cole, which was bombed on October 12, 2000, quote, and one Al-Qaeda operative was overheard saying to the other, don't worry, we're planning something so big now that the U.S. will have to respond, unquote. It's interesting that Judith Miller got jailed and basically had her career destroyed for the Valerie Plame leak. She didn't write anything about that. And Robert Novak, who did, and Robert Novak being an administration shill, has done no time at all. At some point, we're going to tackle the Valerie Plame situation. I think it's far more complex than we have been told. But do note there the Judith Miller situation. Again, I've noted in connection with the Iraq invasion that basically the U.S. fell into a trap. I don't think it took a lot of guile to set such a trap. I think in light of the tenor of this administration, I think it took about as much skill as setting out a pot of honey in front of a marauding bear. The bear is going to go for it, and sure enough, in this case, the bear went for it. But again, I would note that the Bush is actually furthering the agenda of bin Laden. And I believe very firmly that the elements pulling both Bush's strings and the elements pulling bin Laden's strings are one and the same. At one level, the multinational corporate community. At another level, the Saudi oil interests, heavily invested in the multinational corporate community. And at the most profound level, the underground Reich, which with its Japanese fascist allies came to dominate the multinational corporate community as a result of the economic outcome of World War II. Japan and Germany lost on the battlefield, but they acquired control over the liquid wealth of both Europe and Asia, so they won economically and politically. Considering Bush and bin Laden and the danse macabre in which they have both involved all of us to one extent or another, note the following article. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, June 29th of 2006. It's an article by Bob Deans of the Cox News Service headlined, U.S. Losing Fight Against Terrorism, Security Experts Say. And in this article and in the previous article, I think regular listeners, will recognize many themes, many things that I have been saying as well. Now, elements far more powerful and far more influential than yours truly are beginning to say the same things, including people from the Council on Foreign Relations in Foreign Policy magazine. The following article reads in part, the United States is losing its fight against terrorism, and the Iraq War is the biggest reason. More than 8 of 10 American terrorism and national security experts concluded in a poll released Wednesday. One participant in the survey, a former CIA official who describes himself as a conservative Republican, said the war in Iraq has provided global terrorist groups with a recruiting bonanza, a valuable training ground, and a strategic beachhead at the crossroads of the oil-rich Persian Gulf and Turkey, the traditional land bridge linking the Middle East to Europe. Quote, the war in Iraq broke our back in the war on terror, unquote, said the former official Michael Scheuer, the author of Imperial Hubris, a book highly critical of the Bush administration's anti-terrorism strategy and tactics. It has made everything more difficult and the threat more existential, unquote. I think at a military/analytical level, the Muslim Brotherhood and its various offshoots from Al-Qaeda to Hamas to Palestinian Islamic Jihad could be viewed as proxy warriors being used by the underground Reich against, among other elements, the U.S. and also Israel. But note that some of the areas such as Iraq, where we have now seen U.S. arms bringing in Muslim fundamentalists to power, if the economy of Iraq under Saddam Hussein was rather like the economy of Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser or the Syrian economy. Although there is some private enterprise, it was in many ways state controlled. No longer, because as noted in the very first article that we read from Newsweek, the Shia-dominated government in Iraq barely revised the free market blueprint for that country drawn up by Grover Norquist, a member of the Islamic Institute and an ally of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. In assessing economics 911, one cannot overlook the petroleum industry and the implications of these various events for the petroleum industry. The more time has passed, the more I've come to believe that it is the violence itself, it is the instability itself in this key strategic region that in many ways is the most important goal of some of the macro-political and macroeconomic forces that are guiding the chaos, if indeed chaos could be guided, because it is that very instability. It is the combat in Iraq, the threat of war, even perhaps nuclear war with Iran, and that instability that is driving up oil prices. And it is the increase in oil prices that is basically affecting a huge, huge global-wide transfer of wealth. One of the things that led to the political reaction of the late 1970s and early 1980s, and specifically embodied in the ascent of Margaret Thatcher in Britain, was the collapse of center and center-left social democracies throughout Europe and also elsewhere in the world, precipitated by the enormous increase in oil prices as a result of the 1973 Arab oil embargo. Everything and everybody on Earth uses petroleum directly or indirectly. And with the increase in oil prices as a result of the Arab oil embargo of 1973, a ripple effect took place throughout the industrialized world, and those institutions least able to absorb the inflationary increase as a result of oil prices were squeezed or in many cases decimated. It is still not understood by most people how political reaction, the profound political reaction embodied by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, was in many ways an outgrowth of the economic effects of the Arab oil embargo. And once again, as oil prices are soaring, we are looking at a tremendous transfer of wealth. If you, say, for the sake of argument, if you were a thief, and you wanted to rob everybody on the face of the earth on a daily basis, well, you're not going to be able to mug everybody on the face of the earth, stick a gun in their face, and say, your money or your life. On the other hand, if you jack up the price of oil because everybody uses it directly or indirectly, you are affecting a hands-on transfer of wealth from every individual and every institution in this country. And that wealth is going into the hands of some truly foul interests, from the Saudis and Islamo-fascists to the petroleum-related interests in this country as well. And by the way, too, it's sort of interesting to see Saudi Arabia portrayed as some sort of helpless third-world victim. For people who are viewing that, just bear in mind, sort of political shorthand, in the late 1990s, the Saudis hired an American neo-Nazi, William Grimstead, as a Washington lobbyist. So it's kind of funny because when one criticizes the Saudis, there are elements in the so-called progressive sector in this country that label one a racist or a bigot, which is really ironic. The Saudis hired an American Nazi as a Washington lobbyist. That's rather bigoted. We're obviously, due to the limitations of time, going to have to go into some of the oil links here at greater length. Perhaps I'll do another in my series of broadcasts about trouble on oil waters. But note the following. This is from the Financial Times of London of Monday, May 15th of 2006. This is an article by Guy Dinmore in Washington, headlined, U.S. must beware rise in Al-Qaeda oil strikes. The U.S. and its Arab allies must expect an increase in attacks on their oil infrastructure in the next phase of the war by Al-Qaeda targeting the U.S. economy, the former Central Intelligence Agency official who was responsible for hunting down Osama bin Laden warns today. Writing for the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington security think tank, Michael Scheuer says Mr. bin Laden's intention to bankrupt the U.S. economy by driving up world oil prices is very likely to lead to attacks inside the U.S. by Al-Qaeda, its allies, or unrelated groups. Houston's gas refineries, oil import facilities, and ship canal and pipeline systems, and the Trans-Alaska pipeline are potential targets. Al-Qaeda's failed attack on Saudi Arabia's Abqaiq facilities on February 24th, which led to a $2 a barrel jump in world oil prices, should also be seen as the beginning of a new and more systematic phase of targeting of the kingdom's oil infrastructure. 2 days after the attack, an Al-Qaeda-affiliated cleric issued a religious justification for attacking oil processing installations. The cleric, using the internet, also claimed that attacks on prominent Muslim oil officials were justified. The militant organization's media apparatus is also being used, quote, to stir the troubled pot of oil-related international worries, unquote, Mr. Scheuer writes. noting encouragement for Nigerian insurgents in the Niger Delta and Mujahideen in the Caspian Sea region. Tracing al-Qaeda's evolving strategy, Mr. Shorier, who left the CIA in 2004, notes that Mr. bin Laden has never threatened to cut oil supplies to the U.S. Instead, he is driven by the belief that Muslim oil is bought too cheaply. In December 2004, Mr. bin Laden wrote that a minimum of $100 a barrel was a fair price, unquote. In his September 1996 Declaration of War Against Americans, unquote, Mr. bin Laden argues that oil in the Islamic world is a treasure to be preserved for future generations of Muslims and thus should not be wasted through attacks. As a result, Mr. Shorier says al-Qaeda's plans rule out attacks on oil wells, but focus on the infrastructure needed for refining and transporting oil as well as industry personnel. And of course, an increase in the price of oil is certainly not going to be something that would be anathema to two former petroleum industry CEOs from the state of Texas, one of them a fellow by the name of George Bush, another a fellow by the name of Dick Cheney, currently the president and vice president of the United States. Again, we're going to explore the effect of all of this violence, from sort of the macroeconomic effects of the violence in the Middle East. Again, many people, and initially myself as well, when we're looking, for example, at the invasion of Iraq, saying, well, you know, the U.S. wants to gain control of oil, among other things. There's also been rumination about first Iraq and then Iran pricing oil in euros. I would look beyond that. As things develop, look at the violence itself. Watch what happens to the price of oil when, say, Cy Hirsch writes an article in The New Yorker about military contingency plans to bomb Iran. Watch what happens. And often note that many of the people who are in a position to leak stuff like that have access to the corridors of power, and they could also enter the market short and make a whole lot of money on oil futures. So watch that carefully. We're going to come back to this subject in future broadcasts. This, however, concludes side two of this program. Do not fail to take advantage of the tremendous amount of material on the web. www.spitfirelist.com. Check the For the Record section for long article-length descriptions of each broadcast. A dozen or so great old anti-fascist books available for download for free. Links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU that have the whole For the Record series on audio. Other websites as well, blog spots. Website with the Bush, the declassified government documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. And also, last but certainly not least, there is a page to click on in order to support the work that I'm doing. And unfortunately, I don't get bankrolled by the Muslim Brotherhood or the multinational corporations or the Saudis or the oil companies. Too bad, but that leaves me to my own devices. So if you don't like what you hear, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 560, Economics 911, being recorded on July 9th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.